Today on Against the Grain, given the disparities between the lifespans of whites, African Americans, Native Americans, and other groups, it might seem to be sensible, perhaps even culturally sensitive, to gear medicine along racial lines. But sociologist Leslie Hinkson argues that it represents a dangerous turn in science and healthcare. I'm Sasha Lilly. She'll join me to discuss race, biology, and debt. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. On the face of it, there are enormous differences between populations in the United States based on race. Black women are more likely to die of breast cancer than white women, raising the question whether there is anything biologically different between the two groups, which might require different treatment. But are such differences to do with biology, especially since we know that race itself is not a biological category? Or are social and environmental factors to blame? The rise of race-based medicine is the target of a book edited by my guest Leslie Hinkson, along with Nadine Eller. It's titled Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Leslie Hinkson is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University. Leslie, let's start by talking about health disparities based on race. How much does the health and life expectancy of groups vary depending on race?
That's a very interesting question, right? Because last year, for the first time, we actually saw a rise in the mortality rate of white men in the United States, which is totally unheard of. And I think I think that the wisdom on this at this point in time is that that rise in the mortality rate among white men is pretty much directly linked to the opioid crisis. So that being said, since we have been collecting information on mortality and morbidity rates across groups in the United States. I would say that this basically was ushered in with the introduction of insurance, life insurance in the United States and the life insurance industry. We've seen huge disparities in terms of both rates of morbidity and rates of mortality. So black men die earlier than white men do. The same, black women die earlier than white women do. For a while, we thought immigrant groups that we tend to racialize in the United States were protected against many of the chronic illnesses that we see in the United States, like cancer, diabetes, hypertension. The list goes on and on. We thought that these groups actually are protected against them. We didn't really understand why. But what we see is that over time, as immigrants live in the United States longer and longer, and as we have the second generation, the third generation, we actually see that their health profiles look a whole lot more like the average health profile in the United States and for those immigrant groups that are classified as minority ethnic and racial groups. Their health profiles start looking a whole lot more like those of African Americans.
So if we can then say that there are clear health disparities depending on race, then what is troubling to you about the notion of race-based medicine, of medicine that gears treatments to different racial groups in different ways?
So I think my biggest problem with this notion of race-based medicine is that it doesn't look at race as we call a social construction, as a sociopolitical category, but as a biological reality, right? And the reason why this is problematic is because many of the chronic ailments that we see and the causes of early death that we see in minority groups has a lot more to do with where they live, the level of access that they have to resources such as healthy food, healthy water, living conditions where they can actually walk and exercise, clean air, and also the threat of violence. All of these things are inextricably linked to the health profiles of these groups that we think of as minority racial and ethnic groups. These are the primary causes of these chronic ailments that we find and that drive these health disparities that we see, not the fact that, you know, that someone is phenotypically Black or phenotypically Native American or phenotypically Asian. And so basically my problem is that this is not good science. In order to actually cure someone or to prevent prevent someone from incurring a chronic illness or ailment, you need to isolate the cause, right? Race is correlated with health disparities, right? Correlated. Race in and of itself, in terms of a certain certain genotype or certain biological features that are found outside of the environmental context in which people live day to day, that is not the cause. And so what we should be doing is what the public health literature has been telling us for decades now. Even before that, I mean, I would think of W.E.B. Du Bois, right, in the early 20th century, the Philadelphia Negro, outlining the fact that, well, the reason why African Americans have higher rates of tuberculosis, for example, is because they live in overcrowded conditions. The reasons why African Americans suffer from other types of chronic ailments is because they live in places where they're exposed to raw sewage, right? These are the causes of these health disparities, and we've known it forever. And rather than trying to change what I think of as these pathologies, right, these structural pathologies that exist, right, within our society, rather than focusing on those and changing those, we decide that we want to look, that we want to look under a microscope and try and identify pathologies within certain types of bodies to say that, aha, here's the race gene, and this is what is driving these health disparities.
A listener might hear that and say, but aren't there some illnesses that are particularly likely to afflict African Americans, say, sickle cell anemia? Is there any medical validity to that association?
Yeah, so I'm happy that you mentioned that. So sickle cell anemia is a single gene disorder, right? Single gene disorder, right? Single gene disorders are actually quite rare, right, to begin with. And yes, African Americans in this country, because they're African Americans, are more likely to have sickle cell disease than their white counterparts. But sickle cell disease is not an African American or a quote unquote Black gene disorder, right? Sickle cell is the single gene disorder that comes about when you have two people who have the single cell trait, which is actually a protective trait, something that happened over the course of evolution in order to protect people who live in malarial regions from contracting malaria, right? So you have this trait, right, that, you know, that if you think about it in some ways is actually this sort of quote-unquote superior good thing to have, right? When you have two people with the trait who procreate and they both pass that trait onto their offspring, then that offspring will have the disease. But to be clear, Blacks and people from Africa are not the only people who have the sickle cell trait and who may suffer from sickle cell disease. You find sickle cell in all malarial regions. There are parts of Europe in which you find this. There are parts of Asia in which you find this. There are parts of the Middle East in which you find this. And so sickle cell is this disease that has become racialized over time. And as a result of that, I would say research into sickle cell and trying to treat sickle cell has been severely underfunded in this country for a very, very long time, right? So that's a single cell disorder, right? I mean, we can think of cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is another disease that we tend to think of as being more found more in one race versus another. And so we typically find cystic fibrosis in people who are classified as white. But that does not mean that people who are not classified as white don't also suffer from that disease. And people who practice race-based medicine are the ones who are often unable to actually diagnose the disease in people who are not classified as racially white for very long periods of time, often to the detriment of their patients.
That is the voice of Leslie Hinkson. She teaches sociology at Georgetown University. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, let's talk more about the specifics of the problem of having this racially based outlook as a starting point for the kind of medicine that is practiced. Tell us about the case of African Americans and hypertension.
Oh, yes. So when I originally started thinking that I wanted to study this thing that I was calling race-based medicine and race-based treatment, medical treatment, I thought to myself, you know, there's got to be something. There's got to be a disease. There's got to be an ailment that everyone suffers from, but that doctors treat in very different ways. And so I went about interviewing doctors and asking them, you know, is this a thing? Do people really do this? And almost every single doctor that I spoke to, I mean, this was basically just pilot interviews to help me think about what my research, what my statistical models would look like. And I would say of like the 24 doctors that I spoke to, I think only one said, yes, that's actually a thing. Right. But you'd probe and you'd say, well, you know, what about this? What about this? What about hypertension? And they'd say, oh, OK, yes, but that's not racial profiling or anything like that. It's just that we know that blacks respond differently to certain types of drugs than other racial groups do. And then I'd ask, well, why? And what was striking to me is that almost none of them could recall why it is they thought that was so, or what the sort of pathogenesis of the disease and sort of the ways in which medication would actually help to reduce the effects of hypertension or reduce high blood pressure were. And so that actually got me really interested in hypertension, because it is actually an ailment that doctors will tell you, yeah, we prescribe different medications to blacks than we do to other groups initially, right? And they don't see this as a matter of racial profiling. They actually think of it as actually following national guidelines on the treatment of hypertension, which in my research I found, no, that's not what the guidelines say at all. The guidelines don't say this at all. And so historically, doctors have been treating blacks not giving certain drugs to blacks because they have this idea that blacks are not as responsive to these drugs as other racial groups are, and that they may or may not suffer from more side effects from the drugs than other racial groups do.
And where do those assumptions come from then?
So I think there are a few things, right? So in the initial article that I wrote about this, right, I basically tried to disentangle like two mechanisms or two different types of race-based decision-making that I thought was going on. The first is racial profiling, right? And, you know, and racial profiling, I actually defined as, you know, basically it a form of statistical discrimination, right? So based on what statistics say, or based on what population level statistics say, you know, this individual on average should be less responsive, more responsive to this drug than others, right? And what I found is that for some groups, we actually find that there is a certain level of, there's some degree of racial profiling going on, at least as certain drugs go. So for black men and women, but for black men in particular, we see that doctors are less likely to prescribe them beta blockers because that's what the population level research shows us, right? One of the things, though, that any person who understands statistics would actually know is that you can't just automatically use population level figures or statistics in order to treat an individual, especially mm-hmm. given that each individual comes with, you know, a specific, you know, family history of hypertension, you know, a specific diet, a specific set of their own sort of hereditary and genetic markers, right? And race is this really, like, not, I would say not even imperfect, but this really bad way of trying to say, oh, okay, this tells me right now that this is what I should do. I mean, I think that we can sort of make the leap to what was going on in New York for years from the Giuliani administration through Bloomberg, through the Bloomberg administration with, you know, with stop and frisk policies, right? So population level statistics tell us, for whatever reason, that that Black and Latino individuals are more likely to have weapons, right, or to commit crime. And so what they did in New York City is they disproportionately stopped and frisked Black and Latino individuals, primarily men. And what we found, like, years later is that, you know, the white individuals that were stopped and frisked were much more likely, right? The hit rate that they got with them was actually quite high, whereas the hit rate that they got with Black and Latino individuals that they stopped and frisked was actually very low. And so we have to be very, very careful about using population-level statistics to actually look at an individual and say, huh, I know exactly what it is I'm supposed to do to treat you, right, just based on this population-level statistic that is using this very messy and non-biological factor called race to decide how to treat you. The second type of race-based decision-making that I found was this thing that I call racial valuation. And racial valuation is this process by which, you know, people who are at the top of the racial hierarchy are usually afforded the newer and the costlier, the more time-intensive types of medical technologies in order to treat their ailments. And what I found in the case of hypertension is I found a very, very mixed results, right? So for men, yeah, Black men were being given, you know, the oldest, cheapest, you know, medical technology, pharmaceutical technology, which were diuretics. And what was surprising is that Black women were actually given the newest, costliest.
And what do you make of that gendered disparity of what already is a racialized approach to medicine?
You know, so, I mean, it's a conundrum, right? And, you know, I think part of what's going on is, number one, you know, Black women actually tend to be some of the best patients. But, you know, they tend to take their medication. They come and see their doctors. This newer drug, which at the time, which are called calcium channel blockers, required more, you know, follow-up with doctors. Which is interesting because Black women actually are quite possibly the portion of our demographic who are least likely to be able to afford this kind of costly health care and taking time off from work to go for follow-ups. But that's what was necessary with this newer drug. I think one of the things that I have come to speculate, and of course this is still speculation, is that because it was a new drug, you know, and we do have this history of experimentation on Black women in particular, in the biomedical sector in this country. I actually think that that's actually part of what was going on, is Black women were actually in some ways kind of the guinea pigs for this drug, calcium channel blockers.
And is there data on the health outcomes for African-American men versus African-American women using the most expensive versus the kind of more cheaper and generic?
Yeah, so there is some, but you know what, there's a lot of noise in the data. There's a lot of noise in the outcomes, partly because, I mean, men in general tend to be less likely to go to their doctors, tend to be less likely to follow the regimens that their doctors prescribe to them. We do find that African-American men tend to be less likely to have their hypertension under control than African-American women. That being said, both African-American men and African-American women are less likely to have their hypertension under control than white individuals of either race. And so there's something not quite right going on here, right? The drugs that they're being prescribed are not necessarily being prescribed following national guidelines. And I actually believe that because doctors aren't following guidelines and are using their own logic, I think that's one of the reasons why we see such a relatively high rate of uncontrolled hypertension among Black men and women in the United States, even when they are under the care and supervision of a physician.
Well, you're talking just there about the kinds of biases that doctors may bring in terms of prescribing certain drugs to people based on race, and some of it may be also based, as you mentioned, in using statistics improperly. But what about the motivations for creating drugs that are targeted specifically to different racial groups? Is there money to be made in that kind of approach?
So I think there is the potential for money to be made, right? So, I think about this. So if I think about for me, the overarching motivation for this volume that we put together, Subprime Health, is because if you think about it, like in making sort of like these connections between the financial crisis and the subprime mortgage debacle that we saw that disproportionately affected Black and Latino individuals and communities in this country. And you think about the ways in which Black and Latino individuals experience healthcare. Like, I think about this in terms of like the sort of logics of race and racism in this country across different institutions, right? And the logics are actually quite similar. So I think of this sort of impetus to think about creating sort of racially targeted medications as sort of a symptom of late-stage capitalism. We're at this point in time in which we keep thinking to ourselves, okay, where can we find another market, right? You know, with the markets that we have, which seem to be finite, how do we make sub-markets? And I think one of the ways that medicine is doing that is, biomedicine is doing that, is saying, what if we were to think about, creating different types of pharmacological interventions for different types of bodies? And by different types of bodies, I'm talking specifically about different racial groups, right? Different racial and ethnic groups. We see the same thing. And, if you look at cosmetics, we see the same thing going on, right? And in some ways, that's great. It's great to finally be able to find a lipstick that matches your complexion, right? But that's something that's on the surface. That's not something that's under the skin, and it's not something that's based on fiction, right? We can see skin color, and we can think about what lipstick hues go best with that skin color that we think make us look prettier, right? What we haven't been able to do and what we will never be able to do is identify race genes, right? We will not. We will be able to, for example, see whether or not, you know, certain individuals are nitric oxide deficient, right? And if an individual is nitric oxide deficient, then we should give them this medication for hypertension as opposed to this medication, or give them this medication for heart failure versus this medication for heart failure, right? But people who are nitric oxide deficient come in all races and sizes and genders, et cetera, right? So using race as a shorthand for saying, hey, this person is this race, and so they must be nitric oxide deficient, let me give them this medication, is just bad. It's bad science. It's bad medicine.
And it kind of sounds like what you're saying is that although people of color are going to be disproportionately affected by the negative effects of race-based medicine, it could actually affect all racial groups, even people higher up in the racial hierarchy, because if there is an assumption that certain illnesses are associated with certain races, then someone's illness might be missed, a diagnosis might be missed because they would just not be expected to have that.
Oh, yes, for sure. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, like, sort of one of the most timely examples that I can think of is actually the opioid crisis, right? And so for decades, you know, I kind of feel like every 5 years, you know, another medical school or another think tank comes out, or another center comes out with a report that basically shows that that patients of color, right, particularly those who present in the emergency room, and especially African Americans, are less likely to be treated for their pain than whites are, right? And so what people believe is going on is that patients are being racially profiled. And African Americans in particular who come and say that they're in pain they think that they're drug seekers and aren't really in pain. Or actually even, and this is what I find just so, it is so problematic to me, there is this idea that some people have that that black people experience pain in different ways than other groups. Right, that is that they don't experience pain as much, right? And so they're less likely to be given effective pain treatment. And one of the, I think, sort of, like, I think one of the unexpected outcomes of that is that probably for one of the first times in medical history, we see that, you know, that blacks at large, and African Americans in particular, by being discriminated against in the emergency room for treatment for their pain, may have actually been in some ways protected against the opioid crisis. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to be clear that, like, African Americans, blacks, Latinos are also victims of the opioid crisis. We generally don't get to see them on the news or in the newspapers, and they're not billed as the victims of the opioid crisis. But there actually may have been somewhat of a protective effect against, but meaning that the opioid crisis could have been worse in black and brown communities if these individuals hadn't been discriminated against. And so here we see this technology that, you know, medical science was saying opioids are not addictive for people who actually have pain. And so what doctors were doing is they kept prescribing opioids to disproportionately white patients, right? and many of those patients being white affluent patients. And we see this opioid crisis, and I put the crisis in air quotes. I think it's a huge public health problem. I don't know how one defines a medical crisis, but we are losing people every single day to the opioid problem across the country. And here, for the first time in a long time, we actually see that, you know, that discriminatory practices in medicine actually may have ended up having this really perverse negative effect on white individuals in this country. And hence, as I said, the rise in the mortality rate, especially among white men over the past couple of years.
Fascinating stuff. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-editor of Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Leslie Hinkson is assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University. So you spoke a bit earlier about late capitalism and the circumstances of the Great Recession, which for many people had really profound health consequences. Since you're saying that when we look at race, particularly race-based medicine, we should be looking at these larger questions about social class and the environment where people live as fundamentally important elements of someone's health, tell us about the effect of the so-called Great Recession on the health of African Americans and people of color in the U.S.?
So that's a good question, actually. Since the Great Recession, you know, we have actually seen an uptick in diagnosed mental health disorders in Black and Latino communities, particularly depression, which, you know, if you think about it, if you lose your home and you're homeless and you also lose your job as a result of the Great Recession, I mean, I think you'd be depressed as well. So we have actually seen an uptick in certain psychological disorders. I will say that the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's also referred to, actually came in and helped to provide something of a safety net for low-income, you know, working poor, you know, lower middle class, even middle class individuals, right, who either lost their jobs or had jobs that no longer provided them with health care, people who were homeless but could still, you know, access health care, right? And I think that the Affordable Care Act, at least in some places, had a bit of a protective effect, and I think we actually probably would have seen a greater increase in health disparities, race-based, and also class-based health disparities in the wake of the Great Recession if it had not been for the Affordable Care Act, although that's not something that we've seen across the country, right? We understand that there are certain parts of the country, and I think specifically about Black majority Southern states that disproportionately voted against the ACA. I think that we have witnessed a growth in health disparities, and I think that one of the figures, if I'm not mistaken, that I think grew significantly over that time is the rate of low birth rates among Black and white women, also an increase in infant mortality between Blacks and whites, and also an increase in maternal mortality across race in these places.
Tell us about the importance of debt in thinking about race and medicine in the United States. Debt is a theme that runs through the book that you've co-edited, Subprime Health, in different ways. There is financial debt, of course, and the debts people end up with for their medical costs. But there's a sort of broader sense of an ethical debt that the medical system may have to certain populations. How do you understand debt? Why is it important in thinking about race-based medicine to be thinking about debt?
So I think there are two reasons. So the first is, you know, as I alluded to earlier, is, you know, there have been conversations about us being in a post-racial era since Barack Obama, raised triumphant as, you know, as the Democratic candidate for president, right, in 2008. And so this idea that we're in this post-racial society actually then extended into conversations about this thing called institutional or structural racism not being real, right? And I think one of the best ways to reveal to people that actually structural racism is real is by showing how, you know, there are different racist logics, like, seem to be similar across different institutions, right? That is my definition of structural racism. And so in drawing parallels between between, you know, sort of the mortgage industry, right, the banking industry, and housing, right, in particular, and in medicine as an institution, I thought that this would be a great way to reveal sort of the consistent logics of how race operates in the United States across institutions. And when you have these consistent logics, you know, racism, right, and racial disparities get cemented, right, throughout our structure, throughout our society. So that was one thing. The second thing in terms of thinking about debt, you know, had to do with, you know, first, as you mentioned, the monetary, right? So, you know, basically the first chapter of the book is my chapter on, I think the title was The High Cost of Having Hypertension While Black in America. And I go back to my study of pharmacological treatments of hypertension across racial lines and how, you know, black men are given the cheapest drugs, black women are given the most expensive drugs, but they're also new, and so we don't actually know how they work or if they'll work. And basically showing that, you know, making connections to, you know, sort of the huge cost of medical malpractice, right? And even not just malpractice, things like misdiagnosis and mistreatment, right? And how, you know, if we actually keep using race as a way to think about, you know, biological responses to certain types of treatments, that actually we may be, number one, you know, in danger of overloading our sort of our medical system, you know, with these, you know, with these costs, right, of these malpractice costs. Number two, you know, individuals who are not given the correct treatment, right, you know, they lose days of work, right? There's a cost that's imposed on them in terms of trying to become healthy once again after they get the wrong diagnosis or the wrong treatment, right? And if we think about our economy as a whole, you know, we think about all of these lost working days and lost, you know, levels of productivity, it also then carries over into a cost to our economy and our society as a whole. So that's where I made the connection between, well, race-based medicine and possible monetary costs, right? I can think about Ann Pollock's chapter where she talks about vital and compensation relations, and, you know, and also thinking about Catherine Bliss and the meaning of health disparities and the amount of money that we are actually funneling away from what we know, right, are like sort of the social determinants of health disparities and illnesses, and towards things like genomics and even sociogenomics, which seems like there would be like kind of the social sciencey part. But
can you tell us what that is?
Oh, so sociogenomics is basically the study of how both environmental/social factors and actually genetic factors come together to create certain biological/medical responses, right? So what we've come to understand more and more now is that it's not nature or nurture, right? It's not just genes, it's or just environment, but it's a combination of the two, mm-hmm. right? So you might have a gene that says that you are at risk of contracting, let's say, breast cancer, right? But if you are not living in an environment, right, that actually helps makes that gene express itself, you will not get breast cancer, right? And so this is sort of like, I mean, this is pretty much what sociogenomics is about. It's trying to figure out, you know, what is that combination of, you know, environment and nurture, right, that leads to certain biological responses, certain diseases, certain chronic ailments. What we see more and more is that funding in, federal funding for research on health disparities, you know, on ailments like cancer, et cetera, funding is going away from those social determinants, right? And more of it is being given to studies that want to look at and try to isolate certain genes. And what is very disturbing about this is that all of this research also mandates that race be part of this discussion, right? But because race is being framed as something that's biological and possibly, you know, genetic, right? And we can find a gene for race. That we are going further and further away from what we understand to be the primary driver of many of these ailments, and that is, you know, sort of the environment and the social factors that actually drive not just in general the prevalence of certain types of diseases and ailments, but also the disparities that we see along racial and socioeconomic lines.
Well, Leslie Hinkson, then what you're describing, this turn towards racial categories in medicine as biologically rooted, is this not a reversal of the general trend in the 20th century away from such categories? And to what do you attribute that change?
Yeah, so you would think so, right? But what is so surprising is that even as we made this turn, I would say after the tragedy, the extreme tragedy that was the Holocaust, right? American society basically said, okay, fine, we need to move away from this eugenics talk, and we need to start embracing this idea of race as, you know, sort of this socially constructed sociopolitical category, right? And I think that, you know, by the 1980s, I think, you know, we were like, okay, fine, we all agree that that's what it is, right? Except that turn never happened in medicine and in biomedicine, right? Race was always treated, it has always been and still is treated as biological. And it's interesting that, you know, studies that have, you know, these sort of ethnographic and interview-based studies in which doctors and biomedical researchers have been asked first, well, what do you think race is? The vast majority of them agree that race is a sociopolitical category, right? But then when you ask them how they study race or how they use race in their studies, in the laboratory, it's as this biological reality that they just have yet to find, right? To date, and I will repeat again, to date, we have not isolated race genes, right? We think that we have been able to isolate certain genes that that have to do with genetic ancestry. But what is so interesting to me is that, you know, scientists who are supposed to be these logical individuals, right, don't seem to realize that, you know, we first based race on these ideas of genetic ancestry, right? So it's this sort of tautological thing where we're like, okay, fine, you know, race is a reality. Okay, race is not a reality, but genetic ancestry is. And then you're like, oh, but look at this. Race and genetic ancestry are really highly correlated, right? Well, it's because that's how you defined it in the first place, right? And the primary racial distinction that we have made in this country, in the United States, is this distinction between people from the African continent, right, because they were enslaved and needed to ensure that they remained enslaved, right? So you created this racial hierarchy in which they were at the bottom, and just and thus their enslavement was justified. And at the very top of the hierarchy, you had people who were defined as quote-unquote Caucasian, because they all somehow magically all derived from the Caucasus Mountains, and you know, and they were genetically superior, right? And so this very, very slippery slope of, you know, of saying, okay, well, we defined race originally by, you know, by ancestry, geographic ancestry in the first place, right? Or what we thought was the geographical ancestry of people in the first place, right? And then when we today say, oh my goodness, look at this, like race is actually highly correlated with ancestry, well, that's because that's how we defined it, right? And that doesn't make it scientific at all. That doesn't make race any more of a biological reality. You know, I think that the way in which we are moving, it's not indicative of anything new, because this is exactly where medicine and biomedicine and bioscience has been for decades.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you what people can do to resist the direction of medicine to racialize what maybe social or environmental, both on the level of collective action, but also individually in their own encounters with the medical world.
Yeah, so in terms of individual action, I mean, and I know that it's very hard to do this, right? I mean, we think of doctors as being these specialists, right? You know, there's this sort of information asymmetry thing, problem that goes on when you go in to see your doctor. And, you know, and your doctor tells you about yourself, and you think to yourself, well, you know, she's an expert, you know, I just need to go with that. I think on the individual level, I think that we need to, as uncomfortable as we may be, we need to question our medical providers, right? We need to ask them why they're doing certain things. We need to ask, you know, what's the logic behind you ordering this test? Is there a different test? You know, what's the logic behind you prescribing me this medication, right? Is this the only medication that's available? And, you know, and basically, one need not be a medical doctor in order to do this, right? I mean, the one thing that we all need to remember is that doctors, at the end of the day, are service providers, right? And we, as the consumers, are allowed to question. So that's number one. Number two, collectively, I think that we need to demand more funding for social science research, right? And I think that we also need to hold people in the quote-unquote hard sciences a little bit more accountable for the research that they put out, the research that they put out on race. You know, it's really interesting. In the United Kingdom, you know, they in many ways, they have the same guidelines for the pharmacological treatment of hypertension as we do in this country, with people who are listed as being black as being or as being seen as less responsive to certain types of medications. What's really interesting is that they say that people who are mixed race, though, right, receive the same treatment as whites do, right? Which is interesting because it brings up the question of, well, how white does one have to be, right, in order
Indeed.
To be responsive to a certain drug, which is not a question that we have in this country, because even though laws on hypodescent have gone away, I still say that hypodescent, at least as it relates to blacks in this country, is still some. It's still sort of this kind of like folk wisdom or folk science that we still practice and we still invoke. And so I think that we need to hold the people who do this kind of research and who practice this kind of medicine accountable, and ask them, you know, and ask them to explain themselves.
I'm afraid we're totally out of time. Leslie Hinkson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with the co-editor of Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press. You can find a link on againstthegrain.org. Leslie Hinkson is assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.